Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Frances Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages here in Kilkenny, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery in Thomastown. The show is live today, Friday, and is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. Now, while we're live, we'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch with any questions or comments that you might have. You can get in touch with the show by text to 086-353-7782. You can call the station on 776-2777, or you can email at any stage during the week, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Now, on the show today, and many varied topics today, it's National Potato Day. Mags is going to be talking to us a little bit about fake sourdough in food news. She has a virtual nature table set out in front of us here in the studio. We're going to be talking about nature walks and nature tables. There's some mushrooms to identify, and we're going to be joined a little later on by well-known gardener Dermot Carey to talk about his work and current projects. And of course, there'll be some jobs to do in the garden this week, and Dermot might have some ideas on that for us. Mags, how are you?
I'm good.
How was your week?
Oh, usual sort of variation of things.
Very good.
I started thinking about I suppose fake sourdough, that was big in the news earlier in the week. So the bread makers of Ireland were very animated in their discussions, and there was lots of coverage actually on the national airwaves, which was good. There was a survey done in the UK on, I know you saw that, on just the type of the breads called sourdough that are available in supermarkets that are not really sourdoughs, they're just kind of vague resemblances, so they're now being called fake sourdough or sourfoe. And basically the difference between a real and a fake sourdough is sourdough has three ingredients: water, salt and flour, and then anything else that has, you know, fats or sugars or a long list of ingredients is not a real sourdough. So some very odd terminology I saw in one thing, it said slow baked. Now all the bread makers in the country that I know of didn't know what that meant, so I think it's just a fancy sort of term to con people, really.
Well, people know about slow food, it's a kind of very trendy term, so there's all sorts of slow stuff, so they're obviously trying to piggyback on that.
But it means nothing in terms of baking. It doesn't make any sense.
That kind of misleading food marketing really just gets my back up. It drives me absolutely insane. Like, people are, for the people, it only affects people who are trying to do the right thing. So if you're actually putting some thought into your food and you're trying to buy from a real farm, or you're trying to buy something that's healthy or nutritious or whatever, you can be misled by those terms.
Oh, completely.
If you don't give a damn what you're eating, then those terms will mean nothing to you. So it's actually people who are trying to do the right thing that the marketeers are conning, basically. Drives me up the wall.
So you see, there was some packets that said, like, there was sourdough kind of in large writing. And then if you look closer, it'll say, like, you know, pan loaf with sourdough. I'm not sure how, that doesn't even make sense either. So there's a lot of that sort of thing, which is very unfair. And people who actually want to eat sourdough, maybe they've reasons for it, like diabetes or gluten intolerances, and that they're not going to be getting what they need from buying that sort of bread.
But somebody who has read an article or listened to us talking about sourdough and hears about the benefits of eating sourdough goes out of their way to find some in the supermarket and wonders why they're not getting any of the benefits. And it's because somebody has maybe put in a starter into a batch of 700 loaves that's mostly risen with chemicals or with dried yeast or something. They're not going to get any effect from that.
No, and it's not going to taste like sourdough either. It'll just taste, well, some, I think the flavour has been sort of enhanced by flavourings, not actual sour starter or anything. So, but it was good that was highlighted, actually. It's good, and I'm sure it's the same here. I did have a look in one supermarket, and actually there was no sourdough in any shape or form, fake or real or anything. But I'm sure some of the supermarkets in Kilkenny do have some classifications of sourdough. And again, it's because there's no legislation, so they're not breaking the law by doing that, which is a shame, really, because I think it's very wrong.
Well, it's just one aspect of kind of food labelling which is very misleading. You don't have to go far. Every supermarket on their own brand or branded goods, you can see misleading information on packs and terms that are misleading on every pack, on almost on all of the common food items, you know. Healthy, reduced sugar, zero fat, low fat. None of these things really mean anything. But they could like fool people into thinking that they're making healthy food choices.
Yes, and starch is one thing that can be added. You know, starch kind of sounds innocent enough, but it could be all sorts of things just kind of termed starch. Maybe it started off as some type of starch. And also some things that are used in the processing, they don't, if it's very small quantities, they don't have to be listed. So there's more chemicals probably in things that than we even realise, or additives.
So in the article on sour faux or fake sourdough, was there any mention of kind of figures, the amount that's being sold under this label versus real sourdough?
Yeah, I think it was 1 in 5. In certain supermarkets in the UK.
Aren't actually sourdough, even though they're being sold as sourdough.
Yeah.
I would have thought it'd be more even.
Yeah.
Because there's a well-known Irish supermarket who has a base here in Kilkenny, and I know that they sell under their own label a sourdough loaf, and I would wonder how much actual starter is in there.
It's not even this, how much starter is in it. It's actually the time. It takes hours, maybe 12 hours up to 24 hours to make a loaf of sourdough. So a lot of breads are, well, some commercial bakeries don't want to spend that amount of time, so they'll add in different bits and pieces to speed up the process. And so you might have some starter, but that just having starter in something won't make it a proper sourdough either.
No, of course.
If you have a starter with other ingredients, or a starter that's been enhanced to act much faster than it would normally do.
Exactly. Well, like if we take a half a glass of the starter that you brought into us a few weeks ago and we throw it into a vat that's the same size as the studio here, and then we also add in a whole load of yeast or just some chemicals to give a rise factor, your sourdough starter is not going to have an effect on that in like the hour that's in the oven.
No, but you can list it as an ingredient, I suppose.
Insane.
So really, I suppose people should, if they buy from bakers that they know, they'll actually get a better product.
Time is really the thing that all of these, or many of these claims, are trying to get around. So time is an ingredient in all of the things that we cook or prepare. But for a factory or in a commercial environment, time is an enemy. You know, it's something that you're trying to skip and cheat. And so many kind of shortcuts are taken in the production of food. And sourdough is no different, really.
No. That's true.
Time is expensive. Now, speaking of time, I read on thejournal.ie this week a guide to pizzas, and there were some great tips in there from pizza restaurants all over Ireland. Number one on the list, though, was get your dough right. And a lot of that was kind of like slow dough. So it was, you know, prepared the day before, and there's proving and all of that kind of good stuff in there. So I was thinking we might do a session on pizzas. Would
Absolutely.
Could we do that maybe next week or the week after?
And we can include sourdough, because I always put starter into my pizza now.
Very good. And we might get my mate, the Italian chef, to talk to us a little bit about his favourite kind of pizza tips. But that'd be a great topic, I think.
Yes.
You just reminded me of it there. Now, in other food news this week, it was the launch of the Savour brochure last Friday.
Yes, that's right, actually,
down in the beautiful Rothouse.
Yeah, and actually someone said to me at it, aren't we so lucky in Kilkenny, everybody standing out in the yard in Rothouse, beautiful evening, and nice gathering, actually, really nice. I have to say, one of the most impressive parts of the evening was Minister Creed's speech for me.
Oh.
Yes, which I wouldn't often think, but he spoke 10, 12 minutes completely without a note, and spoke very articulately and very, really well, actually. And this was at, you know, 6:30 on a Friday evening, where he had to travel to Cork afterwards to get home. But so I thought that was really impressive, and he was very complimentary. Of course, Dermot Mullally spoke really well too. Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be another really good saver. One thing that they have this year is they really want to cut down on the amount of plastic and the amount of waste that the festival generates. So as Ger said, something like, we're not just going to talk about it, we're going to make it actually happen. So that'll be interesting to see how they do that.
Very topical at the moment, particularly after the pictures from Electric Picnic a few weeks ago of the hundreds and hundreds of tons of waste coming from there.
Yeah.
Even though there was kind of eco and recycle policy in place at Electric Picnic, it's still, when people don't give a damn, it's hard to kind of police them.
Yes, that's true. But that's part of their plans for this year. So yeah, it was a really good...
And what was the minister talking about? Anything of use?
He was talking about, I suppose, food and festivals and the importance of community and local and that. So, but just that he actually spoke without any aid for that length of time was very impressive.
It's a fantastic festival saver, and I've worked at a lot of the food festivals around Ireland now, and I have to say, It's the best that I've come across, certainly, in terms of the variation of the events that are going on, the facilities along the parade, the food producers that are on the parade, the names that are attracted. Like, it's a fantastic event.
It really is. It brings in huge numbers every October.
Are you doing anything for the for Saver this year?
No.
You have no bread course on that weekend or anything?
Oh, no, definitely not. No.
So you'll be able to get out and about and enjoy some of the events that are on in town.
Yeah, possibly.
Cool. Great.
I know you've got your butchery classes.
Yeah, two classes, Saturday and Sunday, out at Croan, and it's the introduction to butchery course. Proves very popular every time I run it, and it's a full day, so we start kick off at about 9:15, and then we run till about 5:00. And during the day, we'll butcher some lamb, although it'll actually be hogget, but we'll be doing some lamb, and we'll do pig, and then we're hoping to get a couple of deer down as well, and have John show us how to process a deer into venison. Then there'll be
rollicking, isn't that the word?
Yeah. And there'll be burgers and sausages made during the day. Lots of meaty treats to sample as we go along. A very meat-heavy day.
Not suitable for vegetarians.
Well, it is if they'd like to come along and learn the error of their ways. But no, not really suitable for vegetarians.
Okay.
But we have had this year probably the most gift participants in any course that I've ever run. Actually, there's loads of vouchers being bought for boyfriends and brothers and husbands and wives to come along and enjoy. And what I've discovered, and I think I mentioned it on the show before, people are more and more kind of interested in experiences now than stuff. So by the time you get to your mid-40s, you have an awful lot of stuff. You don't really need more stuff.
No.
But a day off learning something new it makes for a great gift. So we've had loads of the vouchers in the post out to people for these two courses at the October Bank Holiday weekend. Today is National Potato Day.
Yes, so you mentioned.
Happy Potato Day.
Thanks very much. I didn't actually know what it was. I might have brought in a recipe if I had known.
The National Potato Day is run by Bord Bia, or it's organised at least
by
Bord Bia. Yeah. And it's, well, not surprisingly, it's in place to promote the consumption of
Spuds.
Yes, indeed. And Bord Bia are very good. They've put together a website, potato.ie, and on there's 140 recipes for potatoes.
So I don't really need to bring a recipe. It was okay.
I thought it was amazing. Potato.ie has 140, as they describe, delicious recipes in less than 25 minutes potatoes.
The Bord Bia recipes are generally very good, actually.
Well, it being an Irish state agency, I know that every one of those recipes would have had to be tried. Like, somebody will have had to write a report having tried the recipe. So I know they'd work.
I've eaten in the canteen in Bord Bia. It's very impressive.
I'd say it's very health and safe wise.
Well, my sister regularly sends around her lunch menus, which you're very envious. You'd be very envious of, really, in fairness.
Really, Our tax money at work. But no, it's great. Fair play to them. They do a great job on all of the things that they cover. And potato.ie, it's a lovely site, and there are 140 recipes, and many of them do look delicious, for everything from kind of simple mash right the way through to very, very sophisticated stuff. And there's a theme to this year's celebration of National Potato Day, and that's imagine a world without potatoes.
Oh, I'd find that hard. I'm quite fond of them, actually.
I love them.
I'd eat potatoes a few times a week.
Yeah. Well, I think most Irish families would. So it's, I think the number is at 4-point-something days per week, potato is in the average families.
That's average. Okay.
Yeah. Now, go back a couple of decades, and that was 7 days a week.
I was brought up on spud 7 days a week.
It was just, what variety of spud do you want today? Chip or mash or
which combination
roast.
You'd like.
Yes. So, but it's still there or thereabouts, right up there with kind of like 4 point something. So it's ahead of pasta and rice and so on as a source of carbohydrate. And they are kind of pushing the fact that it's an excellent foodstuff, which is an excellent source of kind of carbohydrate, fat-free, gluten-free, and all of that kind of stuff they talk about too, which, anyway, that's for another day. But it is unprocessed. And did you know that the potato is the only foodstuff in the world on which you can exclusively survive.
You know what? I did hear that. I'd forgotten it, but I had heard that at some stage in the past. I don't know if they'd like to do that.
I wouldn't like to do it either. But
I suppose you could have mashed one day, chipped the next day, boil, you know.
Yeah.
You could vary it a little bit like that, but still.
If anybody is going to try it, though, the important thing is to eat your skins, because most of the nutrition and nutrients are just underneath the skin.
Yes, that's right.
And a lot of the trace elements and, you know, kind of heavy or soft metals and so on are in the skin. So if you peel your spuds and you try to survive on just the mash or the chip, I'm afraid you won't make it.
You're also better off boiling them whole in their skins.
Mm.
If you cut them, they kind of soak in a lot of water, which you don't necessarily want, particularly if you're mashing them. So you're better off boiling them whole in their skins. I know it's a bit more work. And then taking the skin, if you're going to mash them, you obviously don't want skins in it. And then take the skins off.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
My new favourite cookbook, I was telling you last week, is Jamie Cooks Italy. Fantastic TV show. If anybody hasn't started watching it yet, why didn't you listen to me? It's great.
Is it still on?
He's talking to these old grannies. Like last week, there was an 85-year-old granny in somewhere in Italy, and all she wanted to do was kind of touch him and kiss him and tell him a recipe for whatever the hell she wanted to do.
She just really wanted to feed him. I thought grannies, Italian grannies, just
she
fed
just
people.
Wanted to kind of touch him. She had a young, kind of handsome chef in her kitchen. She just wanted to give him kisses and hold his hand the whole time. It was a lovely, lovely telly.
When is it on?
But I can't remember. I tape it now. But he was talking, we're late to the ads already, but he was talking about he uses the water that the pasta is cooked in now as an ingredient in a lot of his pasta sauces.
Fair enough.
Early on, like about a decade ago, he said the first time he saw an Italian doing that, he was thinking, oh, that's disgusting. But now it's a delicious part of what he's cooking. I do the same. And with the spuds. So if I'm steaming spuds or if I'm boiling spuds, sometimes I'd use the water if I was making a gravy or if I needed to thin down the gravy or something like that. All you're doing is adding a bit more flavour into what you're cooking.
Or the veg water for making gravy.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So always use it rather than just dumping it. Now, we better take an ad break. We're a bit late to the ads. And when we come back, we're going to be maybe touching on some of all of these nature items that you have on the desk. And I know that Dermot's in as well, and we might get Dermot in to have a chat with us. Okay, we'll be back just after these. Text us on 086 353 7782. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And you're welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And the show is live today, Friday from 4 to 5. And like I said, you can email the show at any stage during the week, kitchengarden@corkc.ie, or you can send us a text straight through to the studio here, 086 353 7782. Now, Mags, it reminds me of my primary school days. The nature table is laid out before me. What have we got here?
Well, this is the time of the year for nature tables and nature walks in the schools and that. So I went on my own little nature walk this morning. But I was thinking during the week, you know, it was a big part of our childhood having a nature table at school. I remember I was always bringing in bits and pieces. Maybe I was driving the teachers mad, I don't know. But I remember having frog spawn. Do you remember having frog spawn on the nature table?
We never had it on the nature table, no.
Where did you have it?
My next door neighbour kept frogs in the garden and a little pond, so there was always frog spawn in there.
Well, we used to bring in like jars of frog spawn. Now, back in the day before it was actually illegal to touch frog spawn, and there would have been jars of it brought into school. It was a country school. And then eventually there might be one frog might have actually developed a couple of tadpoles, and then you get a frog. And there was always invariably one frog would get out. The only one frog, you know, and hop across the classroom, and there'd be hysterics and great crack for ages. But the nature table with little, you know, nests and shells and conkers were always a big thing. I think they still are, actually. But I did a bit of a survey this morning on friends and family in different counties. So I had four counties of people.
Oh, very good.
So Tipperary, Kilkenny, Wicklow and Dublin. And my actual sister, who's in Wicklow teaching, she's moved into a spanking new school this week. And she said this morning she was just setting up her nature table.
Oh, lovely.
But so far all she had was one conker.
Now, what age is she teaching? What age group?
Junior infants.
Okay, because I think my kids were mad keen on stuff for the nature table in the early years in the school. And now Charlie's in sixth. I'm not sure there's a nature table there anymore. They're probably just too busy.
It seems to go up to about third class in some schools. But then a friend in Dublin said last year in one school, the teacher brought in pile of different types of apples, and they did kind of like blind tasting and kind of did a chart of crunchiness and taste and all the rest. Oh. Yeah, and then they were able to identify the different apples. That was quite progressive.
Very progressive.
And some of the schools there would have like bits from the seaside in their nature tables, so like mermaids' purses, things like that. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, sadly, nature tables are not as big. They're still doing nature walks. And Johnstown in... the primary school in Johnstown actually brought all the kids into Kilkenny Castle to go on a tree hunt. So they had a kind of like a treasure hunt type thing set out.
Yeah.
And they had to gather, you know, bits from different trees. So conkers and acorns and hazelnuts and leaves or whatever and stuff. So that was quite good. But I think it's an important part of my childhood anyway. Now, I loved that sort of stuff anyway, so I suppose. But
most kids do, though.
Like they do, yeah.
I included the pages that I need to replace most in the guest book out of the cottages are the ones that I put in for kids. And there's a little nature trail for trees, the different types of tree that you can find out at Crowan. There's the poo trail, so you can go out with little photographs of the various types of poo, rabbit and goat and deer and all of that kind of stuff, and see if you can identify the poo. And another one for kind of insects and stuff. But those pages get used, so if the parents let them, the kids will take them out and they'll run around, and I have to replace them more frequently, and I don't mind at all. So if you give the kids some little game to play attached to nature, they'll head off and do it. They love it, actually.
But it seems to vary on, you know, if a teacher is particularly interested, like Irish or music, whatever, there will be a bit more in the class than in other classes. I was actually asking my boys just on my way into town, and they haven't had any nature walks or they don't have a nature table, so that's fourth and sixth class. And I did a kind of a nature thing in the school a year and a half maybe ago.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that. And they were so interested. And once you have a little story or something to capture, you know, you don't want to just like categorise various plants or trees or animals, but once you have a little story with it, they love it. They really do. They soak it in. And it's so nice for them to develop an appreciation and a little bit of knowledge. More of an appreciation, I think, is more important and a small bit of knowledge at that age. So I said to the boys, well, I might offer to go back in and do something in this school.
Oh, that'd
and
be
they
kind.
Actually,
yeah.
they liked it, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be kind.
They're not at the stage where I'm just an embarrassment.
I think that's secondary school.
Yeah.
I'd say now if you were to offer your daughter that you'd go into Loretto and do a chat about nature now. Yeah. I can't imagine that would go down well.
No, probably not.
Right.
Yeah.
She probably told all her friends that her parents are dead and she's, an orphan or something like that.
I'd rather think what she's told them, actually. But anyway. One of the favourite things I found this morning was, do you know what this one is?
No, I don't know what
I'm
that
sure
is.
You've seen it. It's spindle.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
got these fabulous...
Oh, the lovely little berries there, yeah.
And the tree looks amazing, actually, at the moment. Like, it's just so colourful. And the rest of the year, to be honest, it's not a tree that you'd particularly notice.
No, it just looks like a kind of salix, really, like a kind of willow.
But not even as exciting almost as that. So it kind of blends into the hedgerow. You'll find them kind of at the edge of a wood or edge of or on a hedge, but they're a little lobed kind of coral pink, but the seeds are actually bright orange inside.
Gorgeous,
quite spectacular.
Gorgeous berries, yeah.
They're beautiful.
I've taken a photograph now of your nature table. I'll tweet that later on, and actually I might put up a link to my nature trail stuff from the cottages as well on the Crowan Cottages website.
I'm just showing you one of the bright orange.
Oh my God, look at the colour
of
that.
Look at that. Isn't that amazing?
Look at that bright orange.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's quite cool, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So spindle is a native tree.
I see.
And the wood is really, really hard. They're not big trees, but the wood is really hard. So they would have been used for making the spindle of for wool spinning back in the day. But not a tree that you'd see a huge amount of.
Mm.
Well, I'm actually very fond of it. And I've found, if you do see them, actually, you should report your sightings to the National Biodiversity Data Centre. But they are really nice, actually, aren't they?
Yeah, really, really lovely.
Yeah.
And I see you have a sloe here too, from the Blackthorn.
Yep, lots of sloes.
It's a great year for sloes. I've noticed lots and lots of sloes about the place.
Lots of berries actually in general, aren't there?
And big too.
Yeah, and some elderberries.
Elderberries, yes.
Lots of elderberries.
Sambucus, yeah.
Now they're poisonous, are they?
They are. They're very, very, very mildly poisonous.
Okay.
But it doesn't stop people eating loads of them. I eat them myself. But yeah, there is a mild toxin in there.
Okay.
Don't eat the leaves.
Don't eat too many.
No, don't eat the leaves.
And then down at the wood, there's kind of a hazel walk almost. So there's hazel trees like on quite a nice stretch, maybe 40, 50 metres. And there was like nearly a carpet of hazelnuts on the ground a couple of weeks ago. But I'm not sure whether it's the squirrels or the squirrels or the mice or whatever. But there was very few left today. So I managed to find like one.
Oh.
Where last week I would have, or 2 weeks ago, I would have found hundreds of them.
You'll find they're buried about the place now.
Probably, yeah. Or sometimes you'll see them and they've got like a little, you know, something has nibbled a hole in them, little mice. And this is a beech mast.
Beech mast, yeah.
So I'm quite fond of those, actually. And kids love, again, just taking the seed out because, you know, if you haven't seen it, you don't know that's what it is. And the squirrels will eat these. They'll take them out and eat them.
Somebody was telling me during the week about a squirrel. If you give a squirrel an acorn or a hazelnut or something like that, and it's on a tiled floor, it will go through the motion of trying to bury the nut. So it'll try to dig a hole, put the nut down, and then scatter stuff that doesn't exist back onto it before moving on.
Wow.
So it's just instinctual behaviour, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
They've obviously observed that in some kind of lab or maybe in a rescue place or whatever. But I'd often find, as I'm doing the grass the first time in the spring, little trees popping up from various holes where the squirrel has done his job and buried a nut and then forgot to come back for them. Now, you brought in some mushrooms here as well.
I did.
Now, most teachers wouldn't really approve of you bringing the mushrooms into the nature table in case somebody ate them or got themselves poisoned. But anyway, you've...
Don't eat them, okay?
Don't eat them, no. But you've got a little milk cap here, is it?
I don't know. I knew you'd know better than I would, so...
So if you break the gills underneath this, it kind of looks like a chanterelle type. So it's kind of like a funnel-shaped cap on the mushroom, long stem. But when you break the gills on these, they secrete a little milky kind of substance. It's a little milk cap. And there's a few different varieties of that. Now, I brought in one of the mushroom kind of encyclopedias, and there's probably pages and pages and pages of milk cap. Yeah.
Can you eat milk caps?
You can't. No. Well, there is one variety that you can, but I wouldn't trust with this one. And it looks a little bit old. I was out on Tuesday for a walk and I went looking for some mushrooms. And every mushroom I saw, I'd say, would have been better 2 days before. But no kind of replenishment. So it looked like there'd been a big surge at the weekend and then it had gone very, very dry and very quiet.
Yeah, it was a little bit dry. I think it needs a bit more moisture because it was warm during the week, but needed a little bit of rain maybe.
The Lavistown Mushroom Hunt is on next weekend on the 13th, and I'm sure the lads are hoping for a bit of bit of rain between now and then.
I think it's forecast, and this is a little some type of puffball.
That's an earth ball, common earth ball. So the puffballs generally would have a slightly spiky or scaly. They'd be white, spherical, almost kind of small, maybe an inch and a half, inch and a half in diameter. And when you break them open, a little puffball, you can give a squeeze, and it will produce all of the spores out of there. This one is browner in colour, and it has a kind of leopard skin effect on the skin, and that's a common earth ball. But again, I'd say that would have been great a couple of days ago.
Yeah, there was quite a cluster of those actually. Yeah. They still looked, as a cluster, they looked quite nice.
They're quite common, and they're really, really lovely.
To eat?
Just as a species.
I don't have to eat them. This is right.
Now, this other slimy one that you have here, good Lord, look at that. So there is a variety of slimy mushroom like that called the porcelain cap, which is white, and it looks like fine bone china.
Oh, yes.
But it has that kind of slimy effect on the top of it. It's one of the only slimy ones that I know that you can eat, but I've never been able to bring myself to do it.
Eating slime.
Anything that's kind of slimy, I wouldn't be tempted.
You're not really stuck for a bit of mushroom.
But this is one of those mushrooms that can be, you know, if we were to identify it in the book there, underneath it would said, it would say similar species, and the list would go on for about 3.5 pages.
Yeah.
So They're very hard to identify.
They're really nice to look at, though.
Really lovely to look at.
And it's nice when you go for a walk and then a week later and it looks completely different. Yeah. You get new things popping up on that.
I love when your eye gets in, when you're out for a bit of a walk and you're looking for the mushrooms. And to spot the first mushroom might take 20 minutes. And then later in the day, if you're still at it, you're just seeing them everywhere.
Yes.
Your eye kind of gets accustomed and looks them out a little bit better. But for one little walk, there you go. There's a nature
and
table
there was
filled.
So in like half an hour you'd actually see lots, and you don't have to be out in the middle of the wood either. Down most, you know, kind of parks or even the school garden, and that will have, if you look, you'll actually find lots of bits and pieces. So yeah, that was my morning's excitement.
And there's some stuff there that you can eat. So there's, you know, very easily you could find some mushrooms, you could find some hazelnuts that you can roast, you could find some elderberries that you can mix with apple, maybe in a pie, or just have with some cream.
Would you?
Yeah.
And they'd be okay to do that with?
Yeah, no problem with them at all. Like I said, so long as you're not eating a sack of them, it's not going to poison you. You know, really it's trace amounts. And then the sloes, of course, you can kind of chop and put in your gin if you're into your sloe gin.
Yep.
And the spindleberries, are they of use? I really know nothing about them.
No, I don't think they are, actually. I think, they may actually be poisonous. I'm not 100% sure, actually.
The colour's I'm going to take a separate photograph, actually, of the spindleberry, because it just doesn't look natural. The colours are so vivid, and a pink and orange combination.
I actually found it for last year's heritage walk by the river. When I was kind of doing a bit of a forensic check out beforehand. And I'd been thinking for years, I remember one at home on the farm, but I've been thinking I hadn't seen one for a long time. But there's actually a few of them. There's a nice little stretch of them down by the Nore in Thomastown.
Okay, well, I have to say now, I don't have a spindle tree out at Croan, and I can't remember the last time I would have come across one. And I've certainly never seen the berries in real life. So I've learned something new today, Max.
Excellent.
Thanks a million.
Yeah. I might see if I can grow one, actually.
I'm sure there's seeds here. You can take them away and stick them in the ground. You never know. I'm just looking. They kind of resemble popcorn, the little
they're
little
like four little lobes, kind of four little curved lobes in kind of a pinky, corally colour. But it's the berries then, when you open them up, and the bright orange berry is quite spectacular too. Oh,
very good. So all of this stuff now, we better take all of this away with us out of the studio. There'll be no volunteer equipment going into exhibits going into your school from or your kids' schools from any of this. But let us know if you do that talk out in Thomastown.
Yep, I will do.
Right. Now, you also brought in some foodie stuff, but will we invite Dermot in, and maybe we'll give him a little piece of the banana bread, will we?
Yeah, good
great.
Idea.
Right, so we'll take an ad break, and coming up after the ad break, then we're going to be talking to Dermot about his current projects and all of the stuff that he's doing in various gardens around the country. And we'll maybe ask him for some jobs that we can be getting on with in the garden this week. We'll be back just after these. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Call us now on 056-7762-777. And you're very welcome back to the Kitchen Garden on Kilkenny Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Francis Nesbitt, and from Crone Cottages, and I'm joined by Mags Morrissey from the Hedgehog Bakery. You can get in touch with us during the show by text to 086-353-7782, or you can email us at any stage during the week with questions or comments, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And there was a fascinating message came in during the ad break about the spindle, Mags. Did you know that... Oh, Dermot, just watch that desk there. If you're putting anything down on it, it's very... the microphone is very sensitive. Spindle fruit... spindleberries have a laxative effect, and the fruits were baked and powdered and used to treat head lice or mange in cattle, and both the leaves and fruit are toxic to humans.
Oh, I didn't know all of that.
I didn't know any of that.
Right.
But it's very timely.
Yeah, because so you're doing a lot about spindle now.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So the head lice treatment could come in very handy out at a school in Kilkenny that I'm very familiar with, where there's a touch of the lice at the moment.
Oh, not again.
Again. Yes, indeed. Again. The perennial problem. So we may take some of them fruit now
boys
and bake
great.
And powder them Yeah, boys are great. No hair.
No claws.
Now, you've brought in some food for us. You've made
Some banana bread. I thought you might need a little bit of cake today.
It looks lovely. Now, thankfully, I don't think I touched any of the poisonous mushrooms that you brought in.
They were mildly poisonous. I think you're all right. You brought in a good gut flora. Oh,
I love. Actually, I'll tell you what I started doing during the week. I've started drinking kefir every day. Kefir. I think I need to have more fermented food in my diet. So I've picked up some kefir from the greengrocer ladies.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going to have a glass of that every day. It reminds me of yogurt when I was a kid. Like that kind of really strong yogurty taste. It's really lovely.
It tastes kind of culturedy, doesn't it?
Very
that's what
cultured.
It is.
Yeah.
So yeah. But you can get the grains and make it yourself. You know
I
that.
Keep meaning to do that, but
so
I've
actually.
Enough daily jobs to be doing now. It'll be good enough to remember to go to the greengrocer once a week to pick up a couple of bottles of kefir. But anyway, it's not that expensive and it's very, very good for you.
Yes,
now,
indeed.
We're also joined in the studio, delighted, I have to say, after many, many attempts to have Dermot join us in the show. Dermot Carey, you're very, very welcome. Move into that microphone there,
thanks,
Dermot,
Jeff.
If you wouldn't mind.
Okay.
And thanks a million for coming in.
Okay, it's my pleasure.
Dermot, I'm a big fan of your self online, your many varied projects on Instagram and Twitter. You work in some fabulous gardens around Ireland.
Yes, that's correct. I work at the Green Barn at Burtown House, mm-hmm. and that's just outside of Tye. And I also work with the Evoca Group, mainly based in Dunboyne and Kilmeconnock in County Wicklow. I have some other clients as well.
Yeah, is that a Dublin accent I'm picking up on there, Dermot?
It is, yeah. I grew up on a vegetable farm in West Dublin, and it was 100 acres. That was in 1970s, 80s, kind of.
And what were you growing out there? What were your family growing out there?
Well, it was quite traditional, seasonal, like carrots, parsnips, cabbage.
Oh, yeah.
Cabbage
yeah.
was a big one, yeah. We didn't have any greenhouses. And we were supplying my mother's business in the wholesale fruit and veg market in Dublin. So I actually have her on both sides of the family.
Oh, very good.
The growing and the wholesale.
Yeah.
And she was selling the produce to shops around Dublin.
Right, okay.
But her big thing was cabbage. You know, we back then, it was mainly, cabbage, carrots, parsnips, sweet turnips. You know, we've much more variety now, but...
But like veg farmers probably have a much harder time of it now, kind of how the veg looks being so important to supermarkets and so on.
Yeah, yes. The specification is quite tight now on the how the produce looks. But the it was very much local and seasonal back then, you know, but it wasn't only like... People weren't talking about it so much, but now they're almost like buzzwords.
Back then it was just a fact.
It was a reality. Now whether we want to go back there or not is anyone's guess.
But you weren't able to get kale in kind of July.
You never tried to get kale. You weren't able to get asparagus. So for 11 months of the year. So I know we have more. We have a bigger selection now, more variety. But in some ways, I work with a lot of chefs, and they're almost bamboozled with the variety of produce. It's just the and then the seasonality, because there's so much produce coming from all over the world. So, we shouldn't really lose touch, of our own kind of seasonal. Native traditional types of veg, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know any of the chefs that I talk to, and particularly the kind of lads at the higher end of the scale, if they run their own place, seasonality is really one of their kind of major buzzwords at the moment. It's what they're trying to kind of get back to.
It's certainly it works out more reasonable, you know, if you're buying produce in season.
That's a good point, actually. The chef is always looking at the bottom line.
At the bottom line, looking at the costs. But so it's going very well. So I set up growing units for different hotels and restaurants around the country. So it might involve something as small as a quarter acre and a polytunnel up to 2 acres or 5 acres, you know, it depends on what percentage of produce they want to grow.
Well, the Evoca Group, they must go through tons and tons and tons of stuff because they're famous for their salads.
Oh, they are, yeah. But also the Green Barn, at Burton House in Tye.
Fabulous place.
Like, we're just under 2 acres there.
Yeah.
And we're growing 90% of the produce.
Wow.
So we're buying in potatoes and we're buying in onions.
Right.
But that's for 12 months.
And that's a busy place. Yeah. I've been there on a Sunday afternoon and like there's, there must be well over 100 covers there on a Sunday afternoon.
That's right, 120, 140, yeah.
Yeah.
But then, like, if you're growing your own potatoes and onions, you'd need possibly 3.5 acres, close on 4 acres.
Plus somewhere to store them as well.
Yeah, and it's easy to grow for the summer months, but then if you're getting into 12 months production, that's when you need the extra land, you know. So, the owner's talking about maybe going 100%. He wants to go 100%. So, that's... it's a really interesting project, the Green Barn at Burton House.
That garden now was established quite a while ago, wasn't it? Like that it's in its first iteration, really.
It's a very old wall garden. Yeah. The house itself was built in 1710.
Right.
And I've been there three seasons. This is my third season. And we actually have Gil Mellor coming on Friday from the River Cottage fame, and he's launching his new cookery book.
Time,
exactly.
We talked about Time on the show last week, and Gil Mellor is a buddy of mine. He would have taught out at Crowland Cottages a couple of times. Yeah, so
I see. Yeah,
bloody nice bloke.
He's really, as you say, a really nice guy.
Mm.
And he's been out to the Green Barn several times.
He's a big fan of the Green Barn and of your growing. I know that he's a fan of your skill as a grower out there. He's mentioned that to me before. He likes the ingredients that he gets when he's cooking out there.
So it's on Friday, October 12th at 7:30. And there's some tickets available.
I was actually looking at that last night. I was thinking I might pick up a ticket for that.
Yeah. it can be great. It's a really great night. Like we've had him over two or three times previously, and it's a real party atmosphere in the Green Barn. You know, we tend to.
Having worked with Gil, I can imagine how the preparation for that menu now will go, that the head chef down in Burton House in the Green Barn will be emailing Gil in advance of kind of his ideas, and they'll almost have the menu worked out, and then Gil will show up and take a wander around your garden, see something he likes the look of, the menu will go out the window and we'll start again.
Yeah, that's exactly, you know, we're walking around the garden prior to the event, and Gil is tasting the produce, he's picking the produce out of the ground, tasting it raw, and he's coming up with ideas, and so it can chop and change.
I can imagine, I can picture it happening. Whenever I have them at Crowland Cottages and we're doing a class, it might be over 2 or 3 days and we're trying to work out the menu for all of the meals over those 2 or 3 days. And I'd be an organised type, Dermot. You know, I'd like to have it kind of written down and get the prep done. And then Gil would arrive and the paper would all just get thrown away and we'd start from scratch.
I don't know what you mean. Yeah, I really like his style. I really like his style of cooking and the way he approaches it. He's very relaxed about the whole process.
Yeah, and he takes some bloody nice photos as well, and you can see them in his new book, Time. It's really, really lovely photography in there, and a lovely way of kind of describing a recipe. I'm a big fan of Gil's. So that's next Friday night. Some tickets still available on the Burton House website?
Yeah, that's correct.
Great. Now, you have some other projects underway, though, as well, don't you? You're just come back from Waterford. Were you down with GIY there, or?
No, I was down visiting a friend in Waterford. And I'm actually in Burton House now tomorrow.
Tell them all we said hello.
I will. And then I work out in Dunboyne, out with Evoke in Dunboyne, the very large store out there. It's the most recent store. And then, as I say, I work with different clients, setting up different growing units. And
this time of the year, what's the major jobs that are kind of underway?
This time of year, it'd be like clearing ground, maybe keeping on top of the weeds. I will be sowing some oriental greens into the greenhouses, into polytons, and I'll sow them directly into the soil. So then they'll be ready for cutting. I'd say it's getting quite late now. It'll be early spring.
Mm.
So it'll be ideal possibly in the early hungry gap time.
Yeah.
Of March.
Still having something to come out of the ground.
Yeah, so it's very useful if you have a polytunnel to use for overwintering produce.
Yeah.
Because, like a lot of growers, I noticed they grow the tomatoes and they grow the cucumbers and that, and they can tie the polytunnel for a long time, and then very often the polytunnel is left empty over the winter.
Yeah.
So to really... to have the produce during the hunger gap, you could be growing the spinaches and the York cabbages and the overwintering
inside.
Yeah,
it was a revelation.
Growing them inside, would you? Yeah.
A revelation to me a few years ago. I had a load of brassica seedlings that I never got out into the ground, and it was around this time of the year, and I kind of wanted to give them a chance. I hate throwing away seedlings. I hate thinning out, and I hate throwing away seedlings. So I stuck all of these brassicas into an empty bed in the greenhouse. Now, I have a very large greenhouse out there. I produced the most beautiful Romanesco, the kind of broccoli heads. The most perfect cauliflower head I've ever produced in my life. I enjoyed in spring because it came from one of these brassica seedlings that went into the greenhouse over the winter. So rather than have the empty space,
because like if you have a garden and then you have a glass, if you have your polytunnel, then you can have a glut of produce in July, August, September. But then it's great to have the produce then.
For the hunger
gap time, March, April, May.
Yeah, absolutely true. And are you a fan of green manure at all?
I would be a fan. I wouldn't be a total expert on green manure.
Yeah. And do you use it at any of the gardens?
I do. Yeah, I use the you could sow Phacelia now.
Yeah.
Because it's very fast growing.
Fast growing. Yeah.
And I've used the Landsberger mix.
Oh yeah.
It's a mix of vetch, Phacelia, rye. I've used that one. You can sow that one late also.
Now the one thing you have to be careful of with that one is that you actually get it into the ground before it sets seed, because otherwise you're actually just giving yourself a crop of weeds for the coming year.
That's true. It's hard to it can keep coming.
It can, and with the Phacelia, what I found is I've actually set aside a little section in the garden now where I allow it go to seed every year. The bees love the flowers.
It's a fantastic, purple.
Yeah, kind of pale purple, blue kind of colour. The bees absolutely go wild for it. It produces a lovely honey as well, because one year I had so much of it, I got a little crop just from it. Beautiful floral honey. But once it sets seed and drops on the ground there, you can have Phacelia forever. So again, if you're using it as a green manure, it's best to kind of chop it down and get it worked into the soil before it goes to seed.
Yeah.
A lovely plant though, really lovely, and very ornamental. And that's something that you do actually out at Burrtown House in the garden. It's not just about row after row of veg, it's very pretty.
Yeah, you can have the best of both worlds. Some gardeners have the impression, it's a model garden, it's a showpiece garden, people are coming in to have a look. But that doesn't mean that it can't be productive.
Mm.
So you can be very, very productive, and yet it can look quite attractive.
Mm.
And I try to encourage the chefs to go out and, if you want to reef the produce out of the ground, you can. As soon as you can reef it out, I'll replant it.
Put something else back in.
People showing an interest and going out and harvesting themselves. And I normally harvest twice a week
the
produce. But then if the chefs need that in between, then they go out and pick a few herbs and so on and so. And it's a lot of unusual produce I grow that's not readily available.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the different colours of sprouting broccolis. And
expensive if they were to buy them in from a specialist.
Yeah, and a lot of the perishables, like the salads and the perishable, like the different kinds of basils. As you know, Francis, there's a dozen different types of basil.
Mm.
You know, you have the cinnamon one, and you have the lime one, and the lemon one, and the Thai basil. And they're extremely popular in Avoca Dunboyne. We have an Italian chap there, and he does this pizza. He has his pizza van in the courtyard.
Yeah.
And he's a massive fan of the basil and the garlic.
Yeah.
So he goes out and picks. He picks between a quarter and a half kilo a day of basil fresh.
Kitty Scully gave me a gorgeous lemon basil plant when I was down at the Foxborough Garden Festival earlier in the summer.
Oh, and it's very much on trend now, according to the Guardian magazine. the lemon basil as a garnish.
If it's in the Guardian, then it must be good.
But it has a really strong flavour, a bit like lemon verbena.
Yes.
It doesn't have that, that scent.
But at the same time, it's still basil.
It's still basil.
It looks like it, and it still has that flavour.
It's a really popular one with chicken or fish, the lemon basil. another very popular herb I find is the tarragon.
Oh yes,
the
oh,
French yeah. tarragon is yeah. Really, and that's fantastic with chicken.
It's funny. The last time I cooked en masse with tarragon was when Gil was over last. Actually,
really?
we had tarragon on the menu that day. That's hilarious. The coincidence there that you mentioned that.
And essential for béarnaise sauce.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, the likes of lovage now in recent times, you know, the carrot and lovage soup. And, but that's more of an early spring. That's more of a mid-spring herb, you know.
It gets
a bit strong as you get into the summer. But, it's fantastic. A lot of the chefs and restaurants, they want it more unusual and... They want the very unusual perishable type salads and herbs and that kind of. So I come in and set up a growing area and I either pop around once a week or sometimes once a month.
Yeah.
Another one of my clients is Dila restaurant, and they're on Dominic Street in Galway.
Oh, that's a ways over.
And they have a 7-acre farm out in Moycullen and have a massive polytunnel. It's big. It's 100 foot long by 20 foot wide.
Wow.
And the owner himself tends to the growing. So I just pop over. I was meant to go over this week, actually.
Give him a bit of advice.
And so I pop over and I bring my equipment and my machinery and seeders and all of that.
I see you with your mechanized tiller there on Instagram and on Twitter. I get very jealous when I see that piece of machinery coming out.
Oh, yeah, I always get jealous of those.
I must get rid of them myself.
Like I find it's all about systems and all about techniques, but where I'm coming from, it's coming from a field scale background.
Yeah.
So I treat the wall garden or the patch like a field.
Just a small farm.
Like a small.
Yeah.
So I use technology and machines to suit. It's not really coming from a gardening perspective.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's coming from, you're scaling down rather than trying to dig faster and scale up.
The beauty of what you're doing as well is that you have a kitchen and some chefs there ready to use up your gluts.
And as well, France, it's all about the kitchen. It's not about... It's not about me going out and growing. It starts in the kitchen, finishes in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it doesn't start by randomly going out and sowing a few seeds and then arriving into the chef a couple of weeks later and saying, I have some produce for you. Like it's coming from the kitchen, yeah.
Now, you can get in touch with Dermot or you can see his work on Instagram. It's dermot.carey on Instagram. It's at veggieguy on Twitter. And for those tickets for Gil Mellor next Friday at Burrtown House, check out burrtownhouse.ie. But we've run out of time again on the Kitchen Garden Radio Show for another week. Thank you very much for everybody who got in touch with the show, particularly that tip on the head lice and the use for the spindle berries. Really got to take that one home. One of the jobs to do in the garden this week is maybe to pick up the rest of those apples and pears that are lying around and put them to some good use. So we hope you enjoyed the show, and remember, you can keep in touch with us during the week on Twitter. I'm at Nesbitt F, Mags is at Mags Morrissey, or you can email the show kitchengarden@crkc.ie at any stage during the week, and we'll be back at the same time next Friday.